From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Sweetwater, Florida Mayor Orlando Lopez is confirming that a Florida International University student was among the six people who died when a 950-ton span, part of a new pedestrian walkway, collapsed yesterday. Juan Perez, director of the Miami-Dade County Police, says rescue efforts switched today to recovery efforts.
Our priority, which is the most critical thing, is to get to the victims, get to the remains of the people that are underneath that bridge so that we could take them to the proper place so that their families can have the appropriate burial.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board also arrived at the site today. Their investigation could last up to a week. Tim Padgett is covering the story for WLRN. He joins us from Miami. And Tim, start by telling us what more we've learned today.
Well, what we have learned today is what you just mentioned. The death toll has risen now to six. Last night it was at four. And we're afraid once they find the remains of those remaining vehicles under the bridge that the death toll will rise perhaps to more than 10. And we do have the National Transportation Safety Board on the site there now, and they're waiting for those cars and human remains to be removed from the site so that they can start what they call their walkthrough to begin a very thorough investigation of how this catastrophe could have happened.
Well, Juan Perez, who we heard talking about the victims, also called the investigation a homicide investigation. Is that standard in a case like this, or is it an indication that they're suspecting negligence in the collapse?
You could say both. It is standard practice, as long as I've been covering disasters like this, that you do have the police looking in to see if there was any sort of not just human neglect, but really serious, egregious, you know, human neglect that can rise perhaps to the level of manslaughter and that sort of thing. But it was significant that Director Perez did keep mentioning yesterday in our press briefings that they were geared up for what could be a homicide investigation. And I think that shows you the level of the egregious character of this bridge collapse.
Let's talk about the bridge. Ironically, Florida International University is home to an accelerated bridge construction center. They opened it in 2010, and this project was using an accelerated system. What is that, and why would the school have chosen it?
Well, this is supposed to be the future of bridge building. Its nickname is the quick build approach, or accelerated approach, as you mentioned. It's supposed to save costs. It's also supposed to save hassle. What you do is you're constructing the bridge on the side of the road so that you're not disrupting traffic. And you have to remember, this is Southwest 8th Street, or what we often call Calle Ocho here. One of the main thoroughfares of Miami runs from downtown way out into the Everglades. And so there was a lot of concern about not disrupting traffic on that thoroughfare when this very large bridge, you're talking about 174-foot expanse, 950 tons. They didn't want to just, you know, congest, you know, this thoroughfare. So this is the way they built it. And then last weekend, when it was done, they sort of swung it then into place across Southwest 8th Street. And as I said, this is really considered by many engineers and civil engineers as the, you know, the way to go in the future to build bridges.
The construction of this one was a collaboration between MCM Construction and Fig Bridge Design. Are they responding to what happened today?
Well, as you can imagine, they're laying pretty low. They have released statements of condolences and of their intent to investigate this to the fullest, although it will be the federal government, I think, really weighing in the heaviest in this investigation, particularly because there were so many federal dollars involved in this $14 million project. But what we are going to see also, I think, is particularly with the construction company MCM, or Munia Construction Management, which is a Miami firm, a very long established Cuban-American family construction company, long established and very politically well connected, but also has its share of controversies here in Miami. We're going to be seeing a lot more of their past sort of being scrutinized and brought to the surface as well.
That's Tim Padgett of WLRN in Miami with the latest on the bridge collapse in Florida. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there are also major questions today about the safety of the American power grid. The Trump administration yesterday accused Russia of hacking the networks of key infrastructure like power plants and water systems. The news came as the White House announced sanctions on Russia in retaliation for interference in the 2016 election. For more, we're joined by Robert Lee. He's CEO of the cybersecurity company Dragos. He's a former intelligence officer for the NSA and for the Air Force. Rob, welcome. And how concerned should the American public be that Russian hackers have essentially just walked through the door of U.S. power plants?
Yeah, this is where we need to have a little bit of nuance to the discussion. And note, on one hand, it's extremely concerning, and we are consistently seeing more aggressive behavior from states, including Russia, targeting our infrastructure. And on the other hand, I don't want the American public to be fearing, because our infrastructure is actually extremely resilient and robust. We've got to do more in the area of security, but we shouldn't be expecting the lights to go out randomly.
Really? Okay, so one of the groups that security firms like yours are pointing to for this is called Dragonfly. What do we know about who they are, who's behind them, and what their tactics are?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dragonfly is a group, so we've always come up with these sort of made-up names, right? Before we get to attribution to say, oh, it is the Russian state, you sort of come up with a name. Dragonfly was that name. And, you know, this isn't new information, but it comes at an interesting time that the DHS is amplifying it out, and I think appropriately so. You know, we even reported on this to our folks back in early last year. So the American power grid and the infrastructure owners and operators have been aware of it and addressing it for the last year or so. But it's obviously increasing in frequency and in aggressive behavior to the point that the government has decided to come out and say something publicly about it.
Well, you say that the American public should not be worried. The lights are not about to go out. But we do know that the Russians were behind a series of cyber attacks on the Ukrainian power grid in 2015 and 2016. That did leave about 200,000 people without power. I mean, do you have any idea what the motivation of this group would be? Are they just trying to get information? Are they spying on us? Are they trying to tell Americans that, hey, we could do this. We could shut off the power if we wanted to.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons that these type of intrusions can take place. And sometimes we look at them and we say, look, it's only espionage. It's bad, but it's not loss of life or loss of power. But even though I want to be, again, nuanced and say that we shouldn't be freaking out, I will say that this team is stealing the type of information that would be required to go down that path of doing disruption. And I think we must take it extremely seriously because of the attacks in Ukraine. It's just that delicate balance to also say that our infrastructure is more resilient. We've done more in it. We've invested more in it probably than any other nation. But that doesn't mean that we can just wait and stop, because as the threats become much more aggressive, there's going to be a time when that's not true. And we need to sort of make sure that our defenders are staying ahead of the adversaries.
Okay, so as you mentioned, we knew this was a possibility. The industries were warned back in June that the breach had happened. What are these companies doing? What is the government doing in order to kick the hackers out and to gird up this infrastructure, as you say, we have done?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are in an interesting point in time where, for the electric power grid specifically, where the grid itself is shifting, and there's not really one grid, but the grids that make up the electric power grid are shifting in terms of where they're drawing energy from. You know, more gas, natural gas is coming in as an example, and less coal and other resources. And at the same time that this is shifting, we're also seeing a shift in some of the culture from the regulation-like mindset to understanding that they are going to have to put human defenders with the right technology and the right culture in their own organizations against these human adversaries and defend their infrastructure actively. Not only are we seeing that shift, but I also want to add an additional sort of caution there. We are primarily seeing it in electric power. There are many other infrastructures in the United States that are not as well sort of protected and resilient.
Like where? Where are you talking about? What parts?
So I think when we look at our manufacturing, the industrial networks, the more rugged networks where we're actually manufacturing equipment, we're actually doing, you know, power production, those networks are the ones that have historically not done a lot in security. We do need to see more.
This is very interesting. The United States has done the exact same thing as what they're accusing the Russians of now. Our own government infiltrated the Iranian power grid before the nuclear deal was signed with the Obama administration. Are we ahead of this game, or are we falling behind the technology of foreign governments?
I'll say that the U.S. government has done well in prioritizing offensive capabilities. What the government's not good at is the defensive piece of U.S. infrastructure, because they don't own the infrastructure. And we don't want the government in private sector networks. That's not a panacea to fix this, because honestly, I don't think they're well-equipped, trained, or understanding, and don't have the right authorities, regardless, to make an impact on the defensive side. So the government right now is struggling with how do we make sure that we maintain national security of, you know, our critical infrastructures, but at the same time, stay out of the way of private sector, who's actually responsible for most of the innovation. I mean, I would say my position on it is the government needs to do more to amplify out the message and incentivize the private sector as companies invest more in their own culture, as they open up the budgets to train their own people, build that internal capability. We will see a massive shift in a positive way. And the government does have an ability to sort of encourage that.
That's Robert Lee. He's CEO of the cybersecurity company Dragos, Inc. Robert, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
China's National People's Congress is in session this week. The big headline is the removal of term limits for President Xi Jinping. But what about the lack of women? Just a quarter of the nearly 3,000 delegates to the Congress are women. There are almost no women in China's Communist Party leadership, just one woman in the 25-member Politburo. Joining us now is Yun Sun, co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And does that surprise you that there are so few women in leadership positions in China?
It's not surprising, because historically this has been the same thing. There is a pattern about a low level of representation by females in the Chinese politics, and especially on the senior politics in terms of the senior leadership. Usually we would be lucky if we see two women on the highest level of, for example, the Politburo. And the two out of 25 members was the highest level that we have ever got. So now we end up with one female member at the Politburo level. And that's kind of normal for Chinese politics.
And why is that? Why is that normal?
There are many factors in play here. So first of all, we know that China, in the Oriental, the Asian culture, there is a cultural barrier to senior political roles for women, because the traditional definition of women's role in the society is a caregiver. The female representation in Chinese politics is still regarded as for a decoration purpose. So they would like to have females at the National People's Congress, at the Politburo, to show the world that, well, women are important and we are having female representation in our political system. But once they fulfill that decoration purpose, they stop looking beyond this one woman or two women and try to promote more women to join, to participate in politics. Then in terms of the social capitals, in China, there's still this perception and this phenomenon that men enjoys better social networks. Men can hang out with men. Men can hang out with other powerful people. But women do not necessarily have those opportunities to hang out with men, for example, for drinking after work, to gain more social network or social capital. Then, last but not least, in terms of the political system or the bureaucratic system, there are all sorts of setups that make it more difficult for women to advance to more higher level and political roles.
One of the barriers that exists today is that women in China have to retire earlier than men do, right? Does that play a role?
Yes. That is absolutely correct. So the retirement age for women in China is 55, and the retirement age for men is 60. That has a significant impact over the promotion decisions between men and women, because naturally the men will have a longer period that he can work for a particular agency or work for a particular office. So from the organization's point of view, it is more worthwhile, it is more efficient to have a man to be promoted, because a man simply can work on that job longer, and that investment is more worthy in this sense.
There's another aspect of this that I want to ask you about, which is China had long had the one-child policy where people were only allowed to have one child. Now there's a two-child policy. Do you think that that is going to play into whether women in China decide to get into politics or not?
Absolutely. First of all, for anyone to get into Chinese politics, you really have to start from the very beginning. So it's almost non-existent for someone to have a business career for 10 years, and then this person decides to join the government. The government usually doesn't work that way. They don't take employees half the way. They like to cultivate the employee from the very beginning. And that also makes the government employees more trustworthy if the person has been working for the government the whole time. So that means that most of the employees we see in the Chinese government, they have been there since graduation from colleges. So for women, the implication of the second child policy is that, well, it's going to affect their political advancement even more. Because once the woman gets pregnant in the Chinese government, in anticipation of that, their bosses usually stop giving them important tasks, knowing that they will step away from their positions for a prolonged period of time. And another calculation by the Chinese leaders or the Chinese officials about female employee working for them is that once a female employee has child or has children, her attention will be so distracted that she will not be able to focus solely on her job. So that makes the decision-making coming to whether they promote a woman or promote a man much more biased towards the selection of the men.
I was just in Beijing recently, and I remember a conversation with my tour guide there who had lived in China his whole life, and he was asking me about the election in the United States, and he said that many Chinese believed that Hillary Clinton would be bad for China, bad for the world, because they believe that if you put a woman in charge, this is his words, if you put a woman in charge, things go downhill. Is that a common perception in China?
I think that is a common perception in China. It's a cultural perception which is prevalent in the Chinese society, that people see women as more emotional and as more dramatic and as less rational and less effective and efficient in terms of their decision-making capability. So the discrimination against women is not conspicuous. It's not like the Chinese Constitution has a clause or have an article against women having senior political roles. But even among the general public, the perception is that females are inferior. So that's a much deeper cultural and social phenomenon.
So what about this woman who is the only female in Communist Party leadership? Is she, would you say, the most powerful woman in China?
In terms of the bureaucratic ranking, currently she is, because we know the members of the Politburo, they have what we call a bureaucratic ranking of the vice national level kind of leadership position. And she is the only woman who has that. Sun Chunlan, this female member of the Politburo, she started as a worker in a factory in northeast China at the age of 15. And she was promoted during the Cultural Revolution, and then she was in charge of women's work in her city. And then she was promoted within that track to within the provincial government. And later, about 20-something years later, she became the governor of one of the provinces in China. And that's how she rose up. So yes, that does make her the most powerful woman in China. However, if we look at her role, that her real position, other than the bureaucratic ranking, is that she is the minister, the chief of the United Front. So United Front is a department where the Chinese Communist Party deal with other minority political parties that are not Chinese Communist Party. So that's not a significantly powerful or political position compared to other ministries, for example, the Foreign Ministry or the Defense Ministry. So I would say that her role, although her bureaucratic ranking is high, but her real responsibility compared to her male colleagues are still not at the same level.
What does this mean for women in China to have so few women in the government at the top levels of government?
I think for one, it reinforces this perception even among women that females are not built for senior political positions. And females, women in China should not aim for a advanced political career in the Chinese government. So that sends a lot of implied messages in the process, because it does affect the self-perception of women. And another impact, which is very interesting, is that when a female becomes a leader, usually she would try to avoid advocating for females' political rights or advocating for the promotion of more females within the bureaucracy. So it's almost like an overcompensation phenomenon, that we don't see female leaders in China advocating for women's rights or women's promotion because they don't want to be seen as biased because they are women and they are favoring promotions of other women.
How do you think China would be different if there were more women in power or even a woman president?
Wow, that's quite unimaginable given the Chinese traditional culture. When China was first... Okay, so when People's Republic of China was first founded, we did have a chairwoman of the country, although her role was mostly nominal. She was not in charge of the government. So her name is Song Qingling, and she was the widow of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, so who was the founder of the Republic of China. Her role was mostly decorative, and she had limited her role and her responsibility to issues that she worked on, for example, women's issues, children's issues. So coming back to your question, to even have a woman who is the head of the state or who is at an exceedingly high political position in China, unless that person is really in charge of the real power and the authority, otherwise I don't see that person being able to change the political culture or to change the unequal positions between men and women in China, especially in Chinese politics.
That's Yun Sun, who is co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The big political news in Pennsylvania this week has been Democrat Connor Lamb's apparent victory over Republican Rick Saccone in that state's 18th congressional district. Saccone has still not conceded. Meanwhile, there's a strange situation unfolding in Pennsylvania's state House of Representatives. After alleged abuse, one Republican lawmaker has been granted a restraining order against another. But WITF's Katie Meyer reports the accused representative is still allowed in the state capitol.
Representative Tara Tuhill says during and after a relationship with Representative Nick Micarelli in 2012, he threatened to kill her, among other things. Once, she says, he brandished a gun while driving and threatened to crash. Micarelli vehemently denies the allegations. Now, lawyers for the two lawmakers have agreed to a 3-year restraining order, the maximum available under Pennsylvania law. It allows Micarelli back into the Capitol, which he'd been temporarily barred from entering. Micarelli can't have any contact with Tuhill. As a gun owner, he also has to relinquish all the weapons he owns. As she left the Luzerne County Courthouse after the deal, which was reached without a hearing, Tuhill didn't say much, only that she feels safer.
We are safer today, and that's what we were trying to do, was secure our safety, my safety.
As part of the deal, Micarelli doesn't have to say whether he's guilty. Micarelli's spokesman, Frank Keel, called that an enormous victory. Jarrett Ferrantino disagrees. He's the lead lawyer in Tuhill's restraining order case.
Representative Micarelli agreed to a protection from abuse order today after being accused of very, very serious abuse allegations. I don't know on what planet that would seem to be vindication.
House Republican leaders, Governor Tom Wolf, and a number of other lawmakers, including Tuhill, are calling for Micarelli to step down. He has so far ignored them. And in fact, Keel says the 5-term representative plans to run for re-election.
This Me Too tsunami that we're in the middle of, it's extremely important, it's laudable, but in some cases, it may be going too far where it's being abused.
During an internal investigation, House Republican leaders stripped Micarelli of the badge that lets lawmakers swipe into the Capitol complex. He has to enter through a metal detector with the general public. For now, says Tuhill lawyer Terry Mulcher, it's enough.
I think that the House has taken great pains to ensure not only Representative Toohill's security, but also the security of everyone in the Capitol.
Toohill isn't the only woman accusing Micarelli of abuse. An officially unnamed political consultant who works in Harrisburg says when she dated Micarelli soon after Toohill did, he drugged and raped her.
Both of these women made serious allegations of sexual assault and domestic violence, and the House found these allegations credible. You know, in plain language, the House believed these women.
The Dauphin County District Attorney is conducting his own investigation. As it stands, Micarelli and Toohill will return to work together when the House resumes session next month. For NPR News, I'm Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Russians will vote in a presidential election on Sunday, and Vladimir Putin is expected to win his fourth term decisively. State-run polls suggest he'll get up to 70% of the vote, and his most outspoken opponent, Alexei Navalny, was disqualified in December. John Sweeney is a correspondent with the BBC's Panorama program. He was in Moscow last month, and he met with several of Putin's opponents, including Navalny, and he joins us now from London. John, hello. Welcome.
Hi, Peter.
Is that the consensus in Russia, that there is no question Vladimir Putin is winning this election?
What election, Navalny would say. He thinks, in his words, it's the coronation of the Tsar of corruption. Mm. But to give your listeners an idea in simple verbs of what life is like for the Russian opposition, I'll give you some. Shot, stabbed, tasered, poisoned, half-blinded by some kind of chemical agent. That happened to Navalny last year. So you've essentially got an election in which the two people who Putin is allegedly afraid of aren't running. The first, Boris Nemtsov, he was shot dead 3 years ago near the Kremlin. The second is Alexei Navalny. He's been barred in a law case which the European Court of Human Rights has said was unfair. But here's a clip. This is what Navalny said to me about it.
I'm not allowed to run because Putin is afraid of me. And we have just as volunteers more than 200,000 people. Of course, he's afraid of such a power.
John, is that true? Is Putin really afraid of Navalny in opposition?
Yeah, I think so. You watch, I mean, if you can watch the film, it's up on YouTube. It's called Taking on Putin. You can see the lengths they've gone to try and muzzle this man. He spent 2 months in police cells or in prison last year. Every time he holds a rally, the Kremlin or the authorities deem it illegal and he gets arrested. I met one guy, a Navalny supporter, who's a road sweeper in St. Petersburg, and he wore a Vladimir Putin mask, famously at anti-Putin rallies. And in December, two men approached him on his way to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he was tasered, then stabbed twice and left for dead. Somebody found him and he made it. He's still alive.
He showed you the scars.
This man says he believes the people who did this are state security services. Now, we tried to talk to the Kremlin. I couldn't get a hold of Putin or Peskov, his PR spokesman, but we spoke to a man called Vyacheslav Nikonov. He's a Russian MP. His grandfather was Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov. This is what he said.
Russia is a democracy. It has elected parliament, elected president, and I would say it has more freedom of expression than any country I would know of at this point.
After listening to what you just said, that seems hard to believe. But if it is true, how does Russia account for what's happening to these opposition leaders?
Well, in my judgment, it's not true. And they say that these are unruly people and nasty things happen to unruly people in London and in Washington, D.C. I have to say that Mr. Nikonov and I did not get on. And at the end of our conversation, he compared the BBC to the media during the time of the Soviet Union, to which I replied, the difference between us is that your grandfather did a pact with the Nazis and my father fought them. So you get a flavor of the trouble that you get if you start asking tough questions.
Well, and in fact, this did start to trickle down to you. As you were doing your reporting in Russia, you were followed just about everywhere that you went. You ended up in a police station being asked questions about vandalism that you did not commit. I mean, what did it feel like for the Russian surveillance state to come down on you?
Creepy, nasty, unpleasant. So Boris Nemtsov, he's the opposition leader who was killed 3 years ago, another man who Putin was afraid of as a political rival. And I met Nemtsov, and I love the guy. I was accused of desecrating a shrine to Nemtsov. And this accusation is fatuous nonsense. What happened was this pro-Kremlin group called Serb, they took down a picture of him by his old house, took a wreath and put it in the toilet. And as they did so, I said, "Aren't you desecrating a shrine?" Mm. Then we get picked up by the police. And while we're there, the pro-Kremlin media accuse me, say that I may well be charged with vandalism. When we get out of the police station, we're doorstepped by a pro-Kremlin TV channel. In English, we have a phrase, we have a phrase called doorstep, when you go up to the doorstep of a politician and you challenge them.
As a journalist, yeah.
Yes. So I ended up doing a reverse doorstep where I said, "Well, how did you know that we were in this police station? Are you some part of a police state? We could do this because we work for the BBC and we were in a better position than ordinary Russian opposition."
Here's what I don't understand. All these attempts to muzzle you, but also to muzzle the activists that you spoke with. I mean, you give a litany of things that have happened to them, getting stabbed, tased, beaten with a lead pipe, murdered. And yet it doesn't necessarily seem to have worked. They're still talking. They're still talking to you. They are holding vigil at the bridge where Nemtsov was murdered. Is there a chilling effect, or are these people persevering through this oppression?
There is a chilling effect, and they are persevering through it. Some of the Russian opposition people are some of the bravest people I've ever met. What's depressing is the extent to which too many Russians duck away from the challenge presented by what is, in my view, Russia's police state. Mm. And there's a guy called Soldatov who's written a book about the FSB, which is the new name for the KGB. And we were driving around in our van with dark windows past the old KGB headquarters, the FSB headquarters. And I asked him, "Why is it that Russia is not resisting what's happening?" And he said, "We're doomed in a way because of our history. The memory of so many people executed in the basement of that building, the Lubyanka, that's still with people. So you don't have to do much to keep people down."
The unspoken question in your piece to me is, why is Alexei Navalny still alive? How is it possible?
Because of what happened to Nemtsov, there was a huge outpouring of public grief and anger about Nemtsov. It's difficult to articulate this without giving things away, but we were conscious in our interactions of ordinary Russians that they were much more on our side than not. Mm. There was a moment when I did a quick piece to camera on the street, it's not in the film, where I said, "And we think we're being spied on." And a woman who spoke very good English said, "Who's spying on you?" And I said, "The FSB." And the woman smiled and said, "Ah, yes." But it wasn't a kind of negative response. It was, "That's what they do to people like you, isn't it?" It feels that Navalny is in a special position because of his massive high profile. But he is a brave man. I wish that the lowly road sweeper in St. Petersburg, who said to me that Vladimir Putin is a kleptocrat, I wish he could change places with President Donald Trump, because I think the road sweeper in St. Petersburg has a better and more true understanding of the nature of power in Russia than Donald J. Trump.
It does make me think about the news headlines, the remarkable headlines that we've been hearing just this week from the United States in relation to Russia. The Trump administration announces sanctions on Russia over interference in the 2016 election. Of course, in London, Prime Minister Theresa May expelled 23 Russian diplomats after a former Russian spy was poisoned in England. Of course, Russia has denied all of these cases, but after hearing what you've just told me and seeing your report, I do wonder what everyday Russians think about what's happening in their country.
Well, they're not stupid. Boris Nemtsov was shot dead. Navalny's in and out of prison. They get it. If you oppose the Kremlin, if you oppose the master of the Kremlin, you may die. And there is a history in that country of political murder, which is very profound and very widespread.
That's John Sweeney, correspondent with the BBC's Panorama program. We'll link you to his work at hereandnow.org. John, thank you so much.
Спасибо огромное, which is thank you very much in Russian.
South by Southwest is going on this week in Austin, Texas. It's a mix of music, film, and technology, and Ben Johnson is there. He hosts the podcast Endless Thread and covers technology for Here and Now. He's in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Jeremy.
And I feel like I'm the only journalist in America who is not at South by Southwest. But for people who haven't been, just first tell us what it's all about.
Sure. And by the way, Jeremy, just so you know, there is a not at South by Southwest hashtag on Twitter. So you're not alone.
I'm there with those people.
That's right. The short answer is a lot is happening here. Interactive, the tech portion of the event, features a lot of talk about the now and near and far future when it comes to ideas that are sort of at the forefront in the tech world. And it always features some big names, but also a lot of people from academia, futurists, et cetera. That's now the biggest part of South by Southwest. But there's also music that really first put Austin's most well-known conference on the map. Comedy and film are also here. There are premieres, stand-up performances. There's also South by Southwest EDU, which focuses on the education world, and South by Southwest Gaming, which, of course, focuses on video games. But I think perhaps the biggest or most visible part of South by Southwest, at least in recent years when I've been going, Jeremy, is brands. Companies of all kinds coming to have a presence here and throw an expensive party or have a quote-unquote activation, an experience of some sort. I've seen McDonald's do virtual reality here. Oreos do 3D printed cookies here in past years, and lots of other examples where companies are basically just trying to be visible to a real concentration of press and people from the entertainment industry.
And you mentioned McDonald's and Oreos. We're talking about big companies here, not little tiny startups.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, there are a lot of little tiny startups, too, you know, people who kind of show up and plan on trying to cash in on or at least capitalize on the huge number of people that are here and just kind of get the word out about what they're doing.
So when you look at what's actually going on there this year, what's hot this year? What will actually outlast this festival?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the biggest two things that I heard about but didn't actually go to because I wasn't cool enough and was working were a sort of surprise talk from Elon Musk and also HBO's Westworld activation. So Elon Musk came and showed up and talked about going to Mars, of course, starting Tesla, about his fear regarding the dangers of artificial intelligence. That was a big topic, which he actually said was more troubling than nuclear weapons. And he and his brother Kimball played and sang a song from The Three Amigos. That was super weird. You know, that Western comedy movie.
Right.
But also HBO had this big outdoor activation or event that was a sort of recreation of the adult theme park that is the setting for its kind of sci-fi thriller television show Westworld. The thing that HBO put together was super fancy. It had actors dressed up in period garb. People who went to the event got very nice cowboy hats that they got to keep. There was a lot of talk about that one. It seemed like it won the most talked about award. Wu-Tang Clan's RZA shared a venue with the Russian resistance punk rock band Pussy Riot. And last, just a movie that seemed to get some interesting attention was a documentary called The Bill Murray Stories, which is about this reputation the actor Bill Murray has for doing wacky things.
a lot of this stuff, Ben, sounds very promotional and all about entertainment. Were there real substantive conversations there this year?
Yeah, I would say yes. You know, I think the conference and festival is in a lot of ways about sort of taking the pulse of what's hot and what's happening and also just sort of getting in front of people's eyeballs. But there's a lot of super serious discussion happening among super serious people. One of the people that I spoke with this week was Andrea Little Limbago, and she's a cybersecurity expert who used to work for the Department of Defense. And she was here talking about Russian interference in elections and sort of new attack vectors for hackers and people out there in the world trying to do harm. And she was actually talking a little bit about LinkedIn.
Yeah, there's a group called Cobalt Gypsy, which is linked to an Iranian group who leverages LinkedIn to figure out who the specific contacts might be within the defense sector or energy companies, financial companies within the Middle East and the U.S., and then they create fake personas and they reach out to those people. And once those LinkedIn connections are made, they then navigate to Facebook and other platforms, and they eventually create either in-person relations, or they also can trick the people to downloading malicious software. So LinkedIn actually is, and Russia actually as well has been using LinkedIn for that purpose.
Andrew is doing a kind of bleeding edge talk there about how bad actors are taking a holistic approach to campaigns of influence and interference in things like elections or large news events in the U.S. and abroad. And she's sort of talking about the different tools that hackers use. So that was pretty serious in the weeds discussion happening at South by Southwest around big topics that matter to people around the country. It's not just all free tacos and cowboy hats, Jeremy, I swear.
Ben Johnson, the host of Endless Thread and a tech correspondent for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.